From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. On the program today, the White House threatens to veto the latest congressional moves to derail the president's healthcare reforms.
By allowing insurers to sell new policies to new customers that don't meet the standards is, deliberately or not, designed to undermine the Affordable Care Act in the long run.
Also today, is the Chinese gulag about to become a thing of the past? The Filipino nurses in Baltimore working to bring typhoon relief to their homeland.
When I see children still wearing the same clothes that they wore when the tragedy hit, it's really very, very heartbreaking.
We'll look at one of the world's most underreported humanitarian disasters in the Central African Republic. And 150 years on, the Gettysburg Apology. That's coming up on FSN Reports after our summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. The Obama administration is continuing to apologize for the shortcomings of the launch of major provisions of the Health Care Insurance Act as the U.S. Congress took matters into its own hands. The U.S. House of Representatives has passed a bill which would allow people to retain policies that have been canceled in recent weeks because they do not meet the new standards of the Affordable Care Act. Our Washington correspondent Priscilla Huff has an update.
The apologies just keep flowing from the Obama administration over the mess made by the Affordable Care Act in the health insurance marketplace. Spokesman Jay Carney.
The fact is, we did not anticipate that the problems that occurred on October 1st and in the aftermath were going to happen.
President Obama himself met with insurance executives over his proposal to allow Americans to retain canceled policies. The policies were canceled because they do not meet the new standards of the new law. But industry and regulators are resisting the president's revised policy. At the same time, 39 Democrats have crossed the aisle to vote for a bill in the U.S. House of Representatives to allow Americans to, quote, keep their health care. Another sign of the political frustration over the botched implementation of the law.
Chinese media reports that the state is set to relax its longstanding one-child policy. Families will now be allowed to have two children if one of the parents was themselves a single child. Though the program successfully curbed China's population crisis, it has had unpopular side effects, including the unintentional creation of a large gender imbalance in China, where there are now 24 million more men than women, as many families preferred their only child to be male. The news comes after a key meeting of China's governing Communist Party, where a variety of legislation was discussed. China has also reportedly decided to ban labor camps in a bid to improve their human rights record. The confirmed death toll from the devastating typhoon that hit the Philippines has risen to 3,621 people dead. A week after the storm, food and supplies are now beginning to reach survivors, but the scale of need is said to be enormous. And a British charity says aid agencies and authorities in the Philippines must work to combat the increased risks of child trafficking and abuse in the wake of Typhoon Haiyan. Charity World Vision says past disasters have seen an increase in the numbers of children trafficked out of the country to work as prostitutes or in forced labor. World Vision's child protection specialist Erica Hall says emergency responders must be vigilant to these particular dangers to children.
In a disaster like this, children are separated from their families, they may have lost their families, and there are great risks of things like trafficking, illegal adoption, criminal gangs who are able to operate in the void that exists and exploit or abuse children.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. America's Central Intelligence Agency is reportedly scooping up in bulk records of international money transfers. The previously undisclosed program is said to rely on the same law used by the National Security Agency to collect details of a huge volume of phone calls. The revelation about the CIA's activities comes amidst a debate about the balance between security and privacy, sparked by the actions of fugitive whistleblower Edward Snowden. Malcolm Brown reports from Washington.
The New York Times reports that the CIA is secretly collecting money transfer records from companies like Western Union, including transactions entering and leaving the U.S. Anonymous officials said the program was authorized by provisions in the post-9/11 Patriot Act, and overseen by a special court. A CIA spokesman quoted in the article wouldn't confirm the program's existence, but stated that the agency's intelligence collection is subject to extensive oversight. The Times reports that the revelation is consistent with recent hints suggesting that the NSA isn't the only U.S. intelligence outfit gathering records involving Americans.
Disgraced mayor of Toronto Rob Ford has been stripped of some of his powers. The city council voted nearly unanimously to eliminate his control over the city's budget. The news was not welcomed by the mayor, who was determined to keep his position, despite admitting to abusing illegal drugs and alcohol and making vulgar remarks while in office. And a new report warns that destruction of the Amazon rainforest in Brazil has increased 28% just in the past year. The news was an unwelcome reversal. In the previous 4 years, destruction had been on the decline. Environmentalists say that looser deforestation laws and a government push for building projects have led to increased damage of one of the world's most important natural resources. And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports. 39 Democrats defied the White House today and voted with the Republicans in the House of Representatives to make deep changes to President Obama's Affordable Care Act. One day after the president unveiled what he called an administrative fix for people whose health insurance policies have been cancelled, the White House found itself threatening to veto the House's Keep Your Health Plan Act. It would allow insurance companies to market non-compliant plans to both existing and new customers. The bill's sponsors call it a lifeline for the troubled reform law, but some lawmakers and economists say it could burden insurance companies, threaten the fundamental structure of the healthcare exchanges, and drive up costs for everyone. From Capitol Hill, FSN's Alice Alstein reports.
The fix President Obama announced this week puts the burden on state insurance commissioners to decide whether or not to re-enroll the millions of people who lost their previous health care plan because it didn't comply with the Affordable Care Act. The president invited insurance industry executives to discuss the change at the White House on Friday, and White House spokesperson Jay Carney said it's up to those commissioners, not the administration, to decide if a customer can keep his or her cheaper, non-compliant plan.
Obviously, because we have a system where state insurance commissioners have great authority over the markets in their states, this is something that insurance companies and insurance commissioners will make the ultimate decision on in terms of offering to extend the renewal period or to offer to renew policies in the individual market where cancellation notices might have gone out.
But insurance commissioners in Washington State and Arkansas, along with several insurance executives, have already rejected the president's offer. In a statement this week, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners said since they've already canceled the insurance of millions of policyholders and set prices for next year accordingly, reversing all of that work would be a risk and a burden. Carney countered this criticism Friday by citing states that have agreed to enroll people on noncompliant plans, including Kentucky, California, and Florida, and said the administration will work with states who are still on the fence. But many economists and health policy experts, including Edwin Park with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, warn that extending these canceled plans risks the integrity of the health care reform law.
The ones who are going to be most likely to stay outside in these noncompliant plans are those who are going to be healthier, lower cost. That means the people buying coverage inside the reformed individual market, inside the exchanges, are going to be sicker than under current law. That means premiums are going to be higher than would otherwise be the case.
Park said a bill passed today by the House of Representatives would be even more damaging. The Keep Your Health Plan Act, which garnered 39 Democratic votes, along with nearly every Republican, would let insurance companies market pre-Obamacare non-compliant plans to both old and new consumers alike. Texas Republican Michael Burgess told his colleagues Friday that the bill was necessary, criticizing not President Obama's announced change, but President Obama himself.
Can we really trust the administration that wrote this disastrous missive in the first place and so mishandled the implementation? Do we trust them to now fix it?
During the debate on the bill, Republicans continued to openly advocate for a full repeal of the Affordable Care Act. something they've voted for more than 40 times over the past 3 years. This led many Democrats, including Massachusetts Representative Jim McGovern, to suggest that the true motive of the measure approved Friday was undoing the law, not fixing it.
If you want to go back to a system where insurance companies could turn people away because they're sick, by all means, vote for this bill. If you want to go back to a time when women were charged higher rates than men because being a female counted as a pre-existing condition, then vote for the Upton bill. If you believe that insurers should be allowed to eliminate somebody's coverage if they get sick or older or have a child or for no good reason whatsoever, then the Upton bill is for you.
The House approved the Upton bill with 261 votes on Friday. And the Senate has several of its own bills in the works that would make changes to the Affordable Care Act. Park at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities called a bill sponsored by Democrats Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Mary Landrieu of Louisiana problematic.
Well, it's better than the House in one aspect, in that it's not opening up these plans that are not ACA compliant to new enrollees, just to current enrollees. It does extend them on a permanent basis, which means that premiums under the Landrieu Manchin bill would likely be permanently higher in the marketplaces than under current law, which would threaten their long-term viability.
President Obama has already threatened to veto the House bill, and it's unclear if Senate Democratic leaders will even allow a vote on the measures proposed in that chamber. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
This is FSN Reports. The United States woke up to learn today, on the face of it, some extraordinary news from China. A pledge by the government there to make changes to two of the country's most egregious policies impacting human rights. After a week-long meeting of the Chinese Communist Party's decision-making body, the plenum, the country says it's changing its one-child policy and will now allow parents to have a second baby if one of them is an only child. Also, Beijing says it's taking steps to abolish labor camps where prisoners have been sent to be re-educated. FSN's Kate Fisher spoke to David Dollar, a senior fellow at Washington's Brookings Institution, and asked him what the reforms mean.
I think the common theme in the reforms that have just been announced are more freedom for Chinese people. For example, they're going to relax the one-child policy, so that means more young couples have the freedom to have a second child if they want. They're relaxing restrictions on people moving around. They have a system in which people are registered in a location and it's hard to move, particularly hard to move from the countryside to cities. And so they're going to gradually relax that system. So I would emphasize, you know, more freedom for people to do the things they want and move around. It's be good for their happiness and be good for the economy.
There's also these changes to enforce labor camps. These are coming to an end.
Yes, I think that's very positive as well. I lived in Beijing for 9 years, and that system definitely has a chilling effect on intellectuals and on the population in general. So that's very positive that they're going to gradually dismantle that.
And why is this happening now?
Well, their old growth model has achieved really good results, but frankly, it's running out of steam. They're investing a huge amount, and now they're at risk of building a lot of excess capacity in housing, in infrastructure, in manufacturing capacity. So they really need to shift to a more consumer-driven economy. And these changes have that common element, that they will encourage more consumption.
And also, it's interesting, isn't it? Because do you think the state's actually listening to its people as well? Because many of these policies, like single-child labor camps, are deeply unpopular. And yet they're changing them.
Yes, I agree. And another one is what's deeply unpopular is the state often comes in and takes away land from peasants with very low compensation. And they've announced general plans to strengthen the property rights of farmers. So they're definitely listening to some of the policies that have made people unhappy, and they're changing them. So that's really good for Chinese people.
And these changes are being introduced gradually, aren't they?
And that's certainly been a tradition of recent China, is to introduce change gradually, you know, and to be fair, it's a big, complicated country where there are risks in doing anything radical. But I think you have interest groups that oppose each of these different reforms. You know, for example, there's a big bureaucracy that monitors people's fertility. If you completely eliminated the one-child policy, if you just said, you know, couples can do whatever they want, then there's a big bureaucracy that gets loses its job. This change means that the regulations shift, but you still need a big bureaucracy to monitor people's fertility. So I see all of these changes as compromises where they're significant, but as I said, not earth-shattering.
What do you think it means for the future of the country?
Well, I think their old growth model was unsustainable. So they really need to change, and these are good steps. I would call these significant but not earth-shattering, because if you look in each area, they're taking an initial step. On that household registration system, for example, they're going to relax it for small cities, but for the moment not for larger cities. Or the one-child policy, that's a very nice change, but it still means that young couples are quite limited in what they can do in terms of having families. So I would say these are all significant steps. A key issue will be, do they continue with further steps in the future that really take them to a more open economy?
David Dollar of the Brookings Institution talking to FSN's Kate Fisher. Staying in the Asia-Pacific region, the arrival of the USS George Washington in the Philippines on Thursday marked a point where aid to the stricken country finally started getting through after days of delays and logistical problems. But even as governments and charities around the world race to play their part in response to Typhoon Haiyan, in the US, the large Filipino-American community is also galvanizing a relief effort. Among them, Filipino nurses whose caring vocation means they're especially driven to help. FSN's Lorna Shaddock has been to meet some of them in Baltimore.
Cheryl and Marie, both nurses, both Filipina, work at the University of Maryland Medical Center. As part of a big Filipino community in Baltimore, they've both heard devastating stories of those caught up in Typhoon Haiyan, including some on a ward in their own workplace.
There were two nurses there who have family there, mm-hmm. and they haven't heard yet.
Anything. I have a friend, he's also a nurse in one of the hospitals I work with. Mm. He lost his brother and his sister-in-law.
When Marie saw the first television pictures from Tacloban and the surrounding areas, she says she was struck by just how much help was needed.
Food, water, clothes. When I see children walking the streets and they are still wearing the same clothes that they wore when the tragedy hit, it's really very, very heartbreaking.
And Cheryl was already thinking about what the survivors would want.
I can feel what they're feeling right at this moment. And one that strikes me so much is, if they actually survive from the storm, what's going to happen to them now? They're starving, they're crying, they need a lot of help.
Both nurses are determined that some of that help will be coming from the University of Maryland Medical Center and planned on getting together some kind of fundraising effort at work. But one step ahead of them was Chief Nursing Officer Lisa Rowan. As she watched the coverage of the typhoon's effects last weekend, she got straight on the phone to the hospital's CEO and quickly made plans.
We've established a relief team that is going to look at ways to donate money, food, medical supplies, time, effort, and just really ask them to be creative in any way they can, because many of the people on the team are from the Philippines.
The team of around 20 volunteers will draw on staff from several different departments across the hospital, both Filipino and American, and work alongside the Philippine Nurses Association of Maryland over the coming weeks.
It's like usually like a same-day surgery.
For Marie and Cheryl, it's a practical way to send support and love to friends and family back home. Lorna Shaddick, Baltimore.
And we'll have a bit of good news about the typhoon at the end of our programme tonight. But next, we travel to the Central African Republic, scene of one of the world's most underreported humanitarian crises. After a loose coalition of rebels calling themselves the Seleka overthrew the sitting government in March, the landlocked country of 4.5 million people has been racked by brutality and violence. The United Nations is warning the crisis could turn into a full-blown genocide, and the Security Council is considering deploying a peacekeeping force in the country. From FSN's bureau at the UN in New York, Stephen Fee reports.
Its institutions in shambles, Central African Republic is on the verge of becoming a failed state.
The violence has driven 500,000 people from their homes, and the UN says 1.1 million now face severe food shortages. That's a quarter of the country's population. Philippe Bolopion of Human Rights Watch just returned from the country.
The situation in the country is very worrying. It's really on the verge of total collapse, and we have shockingly high levels of violence and human rights violations.
And now the conflict appears to have taken a sectarian turn. Majority Muslim Seleka militants have been accused of indiscriminate killings, lootings, and sexual and gender-based violence.
But also, and that's a bit more new, groups that call themselves anti-Balaka, which means anti-machete, who are retaliating for Seleka abuses against civilian Muslim populations with frankly, the same levels of violence and brutality.
In an interview with FSN Reports earlier this month, UN Humanitarian Chief Valerie Amos said her people can barely leave the capital city, Bangui.
United Nations premises were all looted across the country. We are beginning to go outside of Bangui again, but it has taken us much longer than it should have done.
Around 1,000 African Union or AU troops are in the country, alongside a small contingent of UN personnel. And while the AU plans on scaling up to 3,600 by next year, the UN Security Council is mulling the deployment of a full-on peacekeeping mission. Again, Philippe Bolopion of Human Rights Watch.
To bring back a measure of confidence from the population, you need a strong peacekeeping mission on the ground. Right now, you have a few AU peacekeepers who have been deployed with not very positive effects, sadly. So we need blue helmets on the ground quickly.
And Amos says the UN's global appeal for humanitarian dollars is coming up short.
We are very conscious of the fact that all 4.6 million people in the Central African Republic are affected by this crisis. We have a huge role to play, not just on the humanitarian side, but in stabilizing the institutions, stabilizing the political situation, and getting the funding in.
Security Council members are expected to consider a report from the Secretary General later this month that could recommend a peacekeeping operation. But some members are wary of committing finances and troops to what's proven to be a grisly conflict. Stephen Fee at the United Nations, New York.
67 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty, and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal.
Next today, The Apology, 150 years in the making. A Pennsylvania newspaper has retracted an 1863 editorial which branded President Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address as silly. The Patriot News of Harrisburg admitted it should have recognized the greatness of the speech instead of suggesting it should be subjected to a veil of oblivion. Earlier, FSN's Kevin McAlee spoke to Chandra Manning, professor of U.S. history at Georgetown University, and she explained why an apology was still necessary.
The apology itself, I guess, sort of surprises me, and I think it probably is a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but drawing attention to the importance of the Gettysburg Address doesn't surprise me. And one of the one reason possibly for doing an apology is if you actually read the Gettysburg Address, it's quite a humble speech. And an apology is an act of humility. So whether or not the editors actually meant to be true to that aspect of the speech, that's one thing I like about it, is it does remind us that this is a humble speech and not an arrogant speech at all.
You say a humble speech, but historically speaking, and in the canon of great speeches in American history, where does Lincoln's Gettysburg Address actually sit?
Certainly one of the ones that people know the best. It's certainly one that helped to define not only how Americans thought about the Civil War, but also how they thought about the whole experiment in Republican government that was the American Revolution. So in that sense, it's certainly a significant speech, but Lincoln's own stance in the speech is really quite humble. He says, you're never going to remember what I have to say here, and even if you did, it's not what matters, because the two things that matter are what people have already done and what we should do going forward. And so I think that's kind of a humble stance.
As a professor of history, in your opinion, what's the legacy of this speech?
I think that one of the things that it does is it settles arguments that had been going on, or at least takes a firm stand on arguments that had been going on really since 1776, when the Declaration of Independence, which of course is what Lincoln is referring to when he says 47 years ago, when the Declaration is written and when it is signed, there's actually very little agreement as to what that declaration actually meant. We all know the second paragraph the best. We all know we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. But actually, at the time that the declaration is written, there's hard evidence that that's not the paragraph that all the drafters agreed mattered the most. And the declaration, if you look at it, does a couple of things. It says, guess what, world? Here is a new political entity called a state, and we're entering the world stage. And then it lists a bunch of grievances. But what Lincoln does is he makes the most important part of that declaration the middle, the second paragraph, the part that says that the point of this nation is to found itself on a principle that nobody's tried before. And so, in a sense, what Lincoln is doing is telling Americans that this is what the Declaration means in much more definite terms than I think Americans at the time of the drafting of the Declaration had been able to do. So it defines the Revolution, it defines the founding of a new nation, the United States, in clearer terms than had been evident and had been present at the time of the actual founding.
Professor Chandra Manning of Washington's Georgetown University. Finally tonight, back to the typhoon in the Philippines. And if you're a regular listener to this program, you'll know that earlier this week we spoke to a woman in Massachusetts, Genevieve Hovermail. She was desperate for information about her son, his wife, and their young daughter.
The last thing that he did say was that it was his understanding that that would be the worst typhoon that ever hit them. I'm completely in the dark.
Well, today we heard good news. They've been located, they're safe and sound, and Genevieve told us a week of crushing anxiety has come to an end.
Last night, my time in Massachusetts, 11 o'clock, my son did call me. They were on a ship on their way to Cebu. We did manage, of course, to give each other our love and caring. And I did ask him, how can I help him? And his answer was that they need everything.
Are they in good health?
As far as I know, they are okay.
Obviously, communication is still tough, and you were lucky just to get those few minutes.
Almost definitely.
Can you describe when he phoned you, when you heard that familiar voice, how that felt?
Oh, it was amazing. I personally, and my son and his family, were so appreciative of the good thoughts that were sent his way. My son and his family have their lives.
A little bit of good news on which to end the week, even as so many other families continue to face so much ongoing uncertainty. And a reminder that if you'd like to make a contribution to the Disaster Relief Fund for the victims of the Philippine typhoon, one place you can go to make that donation is online, www.mgive.org. That's mgive.org. And that's the Friday edition of FSN Reports. Tell us what you think of the programme. Our email address is reports@featurestory.com, and you can follow us on Twitter @FeatureStory. We're back on Monday. Until then, I'm Simon Marks, alongside producers Kevin McAleese and Rebecca Foster. For everyone at Feature Story News everywhere, have a great weekend. Goodbye.